Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-host on this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome to episode 191. That's crazy to think about. It's really fun. It's been an awesome 4 years of doing stuff, and we've had a lot of amazing guests, and we have a repeat guest tonight. But before we get into that today, let's talk about some announcements.
All right. So coming up at Honey's of Brooklyn, which is a bar that is adjoined to Enlightenment Wine Space. So we've had Raphael Lyons, who's the head mead and winemaker at Enlightenment Wines. He does a variety of things, from everything from dandelion wine to meads and ciders. Anyway, that is in Bushwick, Brooklyn. They are hosting a miso class with another friend of ours, Cheryl Passwater, on Sunday, February 5th from 7 to 9 p.m.
of Contraband Ferments, and also has co-hosted and been our guest here on the show as well.
So that is going to be a class on all things miso, and you will go home with a starter culture as well. It's only $25. If you're interested, you could probably just Google it, but I know it is available if you go to Honey's of Brooklyn's Facebook page.
What are you doing?
Oh, yeah, next. Are we just going down my
you're
list?
You're going down your list in order. I didn't toss them back off, but
we're not necessarily in chronological order here, but I am doing a series of free mending classes because I think that we should all be reusing and reusing our stuff more, getting more use out of our stuff instead of sending it to a landfill. New York City in particular sends 200 million tons of textiles to solid waste disposal areas every year. So I think it's a good thing if we can cut that down. Anyway, I'm doing a mending 101 classes. We'll do everything, a series of demos and then kind of collabs. So I'm going to do everything from how to replace a button properly, because there are definitely some tips and tricks, to visible mending and invisible mending demonstrations. The first one will be February 7th. That's on a Tuesday. I think we said it's going to start at 7. That's going to be at Rockaway Brewing Company in Long Island City. I have a second scheduled for February 22nd. Oh my God, these are all from my memories. At Strong Rope Brewing Company, which is in the Gowanus area. And that is also going to start at 7 p.m. I have public Facebook events for invites for both if you would like to learn more.
So you're pairing crafts with beer. So
yep.
You're doing the ultimate craft beer pairing.
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about?
Mending. We'll have a mending technique for each beer on tap.
I love it. And we actually are going in kind of chronological order, because right after your next class, we have Homebrew Alley, a Homebrew Alley is in its 11th year now. It's our local homebrew competition. It was once one of the largest competitions on the East Coast. We dialed it back, and now we're keeping it at 750 entries maximum. But that is going to happen on February 11th and 12th, the weekend. We need stewards. We need BJCP sanctioned judges. Please go to homebrewalley.com to register and lend your support, lend your palate.
And this Thursday is the last day to register beers, I believe.
For that, yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah. if you are local and are able to get your beer in time, this Thursday is the last day to register. But good news, today is the first day to register for the National Homebrew Competition, and we are hosting the Northeast Regionals Round 1 judging here at Kings County Brewers Collective. But if you would like to participate in the world's largest homebrew competition, today's the day. It starts, and so the registration is open, I believe, for 7 days.
It's going to be open from January 30th to February 5th.
Yep. Till Sunday. From now until Sunday, you can register for the National Homebrew Competition, and there are regional, about 13 to 14 regional places in which your beer will be judged for the first round, and if you get past the first round, it will be sent on to the Nationals in Minneapolis to be judged in June. But go to the American Homebrewers Association website and to sign up for that. And if you are in New York, and again, you are a BJCP judge, or you are somebody that wants to learn about how these judges or these competitions go on, go to the site and sign up to judge and or
steward.
Yes, because I can certainly use your help. Harley Levine is the judge coordinator for that, and she's incidentally also the person putting together this year's Homebrew Alley. And Daily Crafton is my steward or my cellar master. So looking forward to putting on that again. But all of this is happening just after the New York City's first fermentation festival ever. And I'm working with Cheryl Passwater of Contraband Ferments, Zachary Shulman of New York City Ferment Meetup Group, and the host of Ferment, and Michaela Hayes, our friends here at Ferment about it. And we're really excited to put this on. On February 25th, it will be the second day of New York City Beer Week, which is a 10-day celebration of all things beer in New York City. And this time, we're doing something that kind of ties all fermentation together. So we're going to have kimchi, kombucha, sauerkraut, miso. We're going to have a science corner. We're going to have the home musicians play. We're going to have workshops, seminars, cheese, fun, people, love, camaraderie, and hopefully you. Go to nycfermentationfestival.com for more information and for tickets. And we can use some volunteers, so there's a volunteer sign up on that as well. We're accepting about 20 people to volunteer to assist us in basically the day of operations. We've got two shifts. And that brings us to, you have something too, right, Rachel?
I think my mic's off.
Oh no, it's on.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Now, I just want to do a quick shout-out. I went to Philadelphia over the weekend, and I stayed with some wonderful friends who are also wonderful homebrewers, you all and Becky. And I want to do a quick shout-out. They had all sorts of amazing things that were racked on their table when I came over, including a carrot one and a rhubarb one, and they had a great red ale, which was the first red ale that they had made, and it was so good that I may have finished the batch.
How was that carrot wine?
They are not too enthused about it. Apparently, no? A friend was like, you should make this carrot wine, even though nobody wants to really drink that. But it will make a good vinegar for salad dressings.
Oh, there you go.
They might be surprised,
bright orange.
So I did a saison with carrot, and I thought it was really good. But I didn't use raw carrot. I cooked the carrot first, so it kind mm-hmm. of got some sugars out of it, and it kind of lent a flavor and a color. And I did it in a pumpkin beer to kind of emote pumpkin, because cooked carrot, to me, can be reminiscent of pumpkin, which generally itself doesn't taste like itself, oddly.
No.
Or like what we think of it, you know. It was interesting, and I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is please brew with carrots and let us know how it works out, everybody.
Yes, I'm looking forward to this carrot salad dressing. It'll be a good salad dressing.
Fair enough. There are a lot of ingredients you can use in beer, and our guest today is from Hong Kong. Well, he lives in Hong Kong now. He's not from Hong Kong. He's from episode 61, Rohit Dugar of Young Master Ales. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Last time we caught up with you, we were in Hong Kong. You had just opened Young Master Ales.
Yeah.
Maybe just even months in. let's go back just so nobody really
Wait, I'm going to interrupt. Yes. I want to know, so you just poured us a beer. You brought us beer all the way from Hong Kong. Yeah. Let's start by telling us a little bit about this beer, because it's
cool. Yeah, it's delicious. The beer in front of us is, we call it Ta Tan Teng Goza, and in Cantonese we call it Ham Ling Bei. It comes essentially from a marriage of goza. Obviously, all of us know what a goza is, a traditional German-style sour salty. And in Hong Kong, if you go to like a local coffee shop called a Ta Tan Teng, you can drink a summer sort of refreshing drink called Ham Ling Chat, literally salted lime 7-Up. It's essentially soda, like Sprite or 7-Up with some local salted limes. So I wanted to marry that idea of refreshment, and obviously sour and salty sort of fundamentally makes sense as a marriage. So we brewed this as an experimental beer maybe about a year and a half ago. We brewed a batch, and it was very popular. We brewed another one, and you know, before you know it, we had to make it a year-round beer. It had to wait till we had our second brewery in operation, but essentially it's a sour, salty, refreshing, you know, goza with some salted lime character.
So let's talk about salted lime.
So salted lime, essentially, you know, we make our own salted lime. It's a very straightforward process. It's salt plus lime plus thyme. So we basically buy a lot of lime and mix it with sea salt and let it age for about 6 to 8 months.
And you're just leaving the limes whole?
Yes.
This is a traditional process,
this
right?
This is a traditional process. Most families in Hong Kong do like, they would do a similar process with limes and other citrus, kumquats, tangerines, and so on and so forth. It just changes the texture and just, you know, unlocks the aromatics in the lime. You know, we have these large glass jars in which we age them, and the moment you open the lid, it's like, you know, the entire room smells of this refreshing citrusy scent. So we just, you know, add a lot of those limes during the brewing process, and also sort of dry hop or dry lime the beer with them as well.
So during the brewing process, you take... So the salt just extracts the juices from it, too. It ends up liquidy, right? It goes in as limes and salt, and it's dry.
Yes.
After a week or a few, you know, some liquid has come out of the limes, and it's a juice. So during the brewing, how are you using it in the brewing process?
Yeah, basically it looks like there's a brine. So during the brewing process, whirlpool right after, so the boil, mm-hmm. we put whole limes... essentially, at this stage we don't put the brine in. We just put the whole limes and let it just mix in at sort of hot temperature and extract a lot of flavor. And after fermentation, what we're trying to do is essentially get more of the aromatics in as well. So that's when we do some cold extraction. So we have this hop gun that we, you know, repurpose and use for limes. And at that stage, we also add the brine, and this is also when we adjust the salt, which is a process of like, unlike brewing a classic goza where you could measure the exact amount of salt, here we have to do a bit of adjustment process because a certain amount of saltiness is added by the lime itself, mm-hmm. and then we have to top it up by adding additional salt to get to the level we want.
So at this point, you wouldn't consider it a goza at all. You have not put salt in it at all to this point,
right?
Or you did a little bit,
but a little bit goes in anyway with the limes, right?
Right.
So it is saltier than a regular beer, but it's mm-hmm. not quite to the level we want it to be.
It's cool. It's delicious. Yeah. I remember last time I saw you, you didn't have it on tap, but you did have the limes. You're like, yeah, we made it, and it was so popular. Yeah. We want to make it immediately again, but we have to wait for these 6 months for these limes.
Yeah, which worked out great because, you know, we could time it with our new brewery launch as well. So, you know.
So let's talk about that. How did you start the brewery? What did you start with? And then we'll take a quick break and we'll talk about the expansion and the state of affairs in Hong Kong.
Absolutely. So when we started, you know, I was a home brewer and there wasn't really any craft beer in Hong Kong. And mind you, this was only like just over 3 years ago. So we started with a small 10 hectoliter or whatever, 8-barrel setup. We wanted to make a wide range of beers from the start because we thought it's almost a responsibility if we are starting starting a new scene, you want to showcase what beer can possibly be to market where nothing exists. So we did a wide variety of things, some classic styles, some sort of more innovative out there styles. And that's something we sort of maintain, you know, to this day. Fast forward 3 years, we ran out of capacity and we built a new brewery with four times the batch size and about 8 to 10 times the production capacity we had day one. And Hong Kong has moved from 0 to 20 craft breweries in about, you know, in 3 years.
In 3 years, yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy, the amount of changes that have come in there. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back on episode 191 of Ferment About It with Rohit Dugar of Young Master Ales.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This is episode 191, and we're in the studio with a very blessed visit from Rohit Dugar of Young Master Ales, who is here across the pond. He is, you've not
from Hong
just,
Kong.
For, oh yes, the other pond.
Both ponds.
The other, both ponds.
Both
two ponds. He has crossed two ponds
multiple
together.
Multiple ponds.
Multiple ponds. you started Young Master Ales 3 years ago when there were zero pretty much craft breweries in Hong Kong. For a brief moment, there was Typhoon Brewery.
That's
out
right.
on Llama Island.
Yeah.
And they were very small. They were like one barrel at a time.
Yeah.
And
they had great English-style cask ales.
Yeah, and they used to serve it at the Globe, which I want to commend again for just doing great things for craft beer in Hong Kong and cleaning their lines religiously, which I think is notable, especially in Hong Kong. So, and which is where I'd like to go next, is what has the challenge of selling beer in that market been from the beginning, and what are the concerns? And what have you decided to do about it for yourself?
Yeah, I think fundamentally in any new market, I think education is key. I think it's you know, ultimately, I think you need sort of the carrot of flavor and, like, you know, the draw from and draw that end consumer's experience towards new interesting things. But then there are in the middle between the breweries or importers or whatever and the person who drinks the beer. There are bars, restaurants, retailers who don't quite, you know, who are set in their ways and do things the way they've done forever. So I think that requires a lot of education and it's a constant struggle. I think in the last 3 years, a lot of progress has been made from, again, just like breweries, from like, you know, from just the Globe, who you mentioned, to now like, you know, couple dozen craft beer focused tap rooms. It's, you know, it's happened in the last 3 years. You know, for us as well at Young Master, I think, you know, what was a sort of a breakthrough for us was trying to break into non-traditional venues where craft beer is sold. For example, our beer is now sold at some high-end hotels like, you know, Mandarin Oriental, Four Seasons, and so on. Those organizations can be very bureaucratic and, like, set in their ways. But, like, you know, but our job is to sort of work every day to sort of try and educate, you know, be in constant touch with their staff, and make sure they understand why it's important to pay, you know, take care of your beer and serve it the right way, talk about the right way, and so on.
And you're also doing this, leading by example, by going directly to the consumer. You have opened up, at this point, two bars as well. There's not a three-tier system in Hong Kong.
Right.
So tell us about your two bars and the influence.
Outside of Young Master, I essentially partnered with a group of other sort of passionate beer industry people in Hong Kong to start first. The first bar we started is called the Ale Project. It's in a neighborhood called Mong Kok, which is far away from sort of the classic sort of, drinking sort of neighborhoods in Hong Kong. But we wanted to make sure we bring the idea of craft beer to essentially a very local Hong Kong audience, not just sort of the expatriate audiences who may be familiar with beer from their home countries and so on and so forth. So we started a very small bar, and that instantly was, had a cult following. And that prompted us to, you know, try and find other neighborhoods where we could replicate it. And we opened Second Draft at a bigger venue as well. And both of those...
Was that in a different neighborhood?
Yes.
But a still similar kind of...
Yeah, similar neighborhood where I think the classics of restaurant bar business people wouldn't necessarily, look at. So, you know, we are fundamentally beer people, not restaurant people. So we had a different mindset. We could see things they couldn't see because we know what people actually want. So it gives an opportunity to showcase that, you know, this whole thing can get a following and it can be viable as a business. Hong Kong is notoriously, tight when it comes to space. So, you know, putting a big cold room in the middle of, 1,000 or 2,000 square foot restaurant, when most of the restaurants would put 10 more tables,
right,
actually makes sense. So we wanted to showcase that this works.
Now, we were out together Saturday night. So we're going to talk about kind of why you came here to New York City in a minute.
Yeah.
But I thought I heard mention now, since you've opened your first bar, that street area has become a lot more of ours, right?
The street, right.
Absolutely. There's three other craft beer focused bars that have opened, and a couple of like traditional businesses, a Korean hot pot chicken place, and like a dessert place. They've ended up opening also craft beer bars in other parts of Hong Kong. So I think we see all of that as a big positive. Granted, not everything is happening with sort of the right degree of, attention to all the details, but the change is positive. It's still, better than, not
otherwise. Not happening.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you mentioned
there.
Putting a cold box in the middle of a restaurant. So here in New York City, and I think most around the country, most bars have some type of cold room situation.
Yeah.
So they're pouring their beers through lines from kegs in a cold room.
Already cold.
But that's not as common in
Hong
Kong.
That is not common at all. It's a very new thing. And I think the first bar that started doing it religiously was, I think, Roundhouse started a tap room also about 3 years ago. It's becoming more common, but I think for us, I think in Hong Kong, typically they dispense beer through a flash chiller and the kegs are kept at room temperature, not inside a cold box. So obviously our bars, we try to change that, and as much as possible, we try to convince our clients to change that as well. However, in Hong Kong, it's not always practical. So in some occasions, what we have to do as a brewery is work with people who would essentially go through beer fast enough that at room temperature, it's still okay if they're using, multiple kegs on a line within a week. I think it works, but, it definitely restricts our ability to serve clients where, beer may not be that much of focus and they won't be able to pour fresh beer if it's if the volume is not high enough.
What is the struggle of competitive prices in Hong Kong?
In Hong Kong... Unlike this is the other side of the three-tier system and so on. In Hong Kong, it is very easy for the macro beer companies to, sponsor equipment and also marketing budgets and things like that for restaurants, none of that is illegal. So that actually prevents our ability to essentially target, a segment of the market. I think we can only target places that actually value craft beer and want to differentiate themselves, whereas the average bar who, makes, essentially would have a tie-up with, say, a Carlsberg or a San Miguel and so on, and all the taps are owned by them, and the bars don't have ability to put anything else on. So that is a bit of a struggle.
Yet now we have, 20 breweries, not all of them as big as you, by ability to produce. Mm-hmm. But these small, you said most of them probably average between 3 and 5 barrels or hectoliters
standards.
Are they finding it easy to stay afloat?
Yeah, I think in the market. I think at that scale, there's definitely what has become very clear in the marketplace is that there's a preference for well-made local beer. Mm-hmm. So if the product is good, I think there are channels. Certainly, bottles and retail, is something where the big macro guys can't really intervene. And also there's many more craft beer focused tap rooms where I think there are outlets, even including the bars that I'm involved with. I think we feature a lot of local beers, so I think there are outlets. The question still remains, when we get to the next stage, when these breweries want to get bigger, what will happen? Hopefully by that time the market also overall sort of develops. And the average bar and restaurant starts to realize that it's not just about taking short-term sponsorship from a macro guy, but in order to compete on quality, you need to, feature what's a good product.
Yeah.
And because you still can't have a tasting room like we have.
Right.
So you can sell growlers and you can sell bottles out of your tap room.
Only to go, right.
That's right. So right at our brewery site, we can only do to go. We're not allowed to apply for liquor license and operate it like a bar, which is, not great, but not the end of the world. On the other hand, we are allowed to open a bar somewhere else that's not attached to a brewery in the same industrial building.
Do most of the craft breweries in Hong Kong, do they also own or co-own a bar? Or what's the kind of breakout there?
Not at the moment. I think there's a couple of examples, but it's still not very common, I think. If you think about it, the whole scene is 3 years old.
Right.
So I think, and of the 20 breweries, about, more than 10 are less than a year old. Mm-hmm. So I think it's eventually I can foresee it happening, people opening their outlets and so mm-hmm. on, but it's not gone to that point yet.
So we met you with Chris Wong at HK Purecraft, which is still is the homebrew store of Hong Kong.
Yeah. And they also was a bottle shop.
And a bottle shop, homebrew store/bottle shop. I think you guys just started the Homebrewers Association. There was like maybe 20 members at the time.
That's right.
What is it like now?
I think several hundred. I think last year there was a homebrew competition. I remember the first homebrew competition had 20, 30, 40 entries, somewhere in that range. But last year, this is, I guess, the third year. The number of entries that we could have accepted was very large, but I think they had to cap it at 150 or something like that. Just in the last 3 years, everything has just exploded. When I first moved to Hong Kong, this was only 6 years ago. I moved from here in New York City. There wasn't even a homebrew shop. I had to buy ingredients from, here or Singapore or a couple of other places which had something. But from that point to now, huge change.
Also in that meeting, we met with Josh, who was making fermented sweet tea.
Yeah.
What other sort of and you doing with the salted lime?
Yeah.
Are there any other interesting kind of culinary influences that you've seen in both homebrew and pro brews of what's been coming out?
I think there's a lot of people trying to incorporate ideas from local food and drink culture into their beers. In fact, I think a couple of years ago they added a local sort of locally inspired category in the judging, which was sort of cool. So we've seen like milk tea porters and like, you know, gozas made with pomelos. We've seen, you know, all sorts of really interesting things.
Wait, what was the first?
Did you say milk tea porter?
Yeah. Yes.
Was there tapioca in that?
There was no tapioca in there.
Oh.
Because the traditional milk tea in Hong Kong is just milk tea, right?
Just milk tea.
No bubbles.
Oh. Yeah.
No tapioca. But that is interesting concept, though.
That's good. I don't think that would work.
You know, gelatinized tapioca.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drank it relatively fresh. I don't know. Yeah. That's an interesting concept.
It reminds me of that the kombucha that has those seeds.
The chia seeds.
Or yeah.
The chia seed
batteries are weird.
Yeah, I can't do it.
It's gelatinous. So you haven't been seeing any specific trends, just everyone kind of doing their own thing?
Yeah, I think in terms of local breweries, I think there's there's certainly some breweries that are focusing on traditional styles or trying to be from, you know, drawing inspiration from a particular brewing culture, say, you know, American hoppy beers, and that's what they do, or, you know, or whatever, English style beers and so on and so forth. And then there is the other group that's trying to just, you know, do some more innovative and interesting things and trying to sort of just trying to build a local brewing culture. It's a challenging thing because, you know, that part of the world doesn't really have a long history of brewing, or certainly not a continuous history of brewing. But it does have a very, very long, rich, deep history of food and drinks, and you're trying to marry two streams that are very deep and very rich. So it'll be a long evolution process. I think that's how we see our role, and I'm sure some of the breweries see it that way as well. We'll keep trying new things, and we won't try to say that, you know, definitively that this is going to be Hong Kong's brewing culture when we are 6 months old or 3 years old. But we'll do many things, and over time it'll evolve into something that's distinctive.
That's fantastic.
Tell us about one of the other beers that you brought from Hong Kong.
Maybe let's talk about Ad Oil, which sounds like a weird name. It's a very local expression, Ad Oil or Gaiao. It's essentially something, you know, people say to others when, I don't know, they have an important exam or an event. It's sort of like a cheer up, do well sort of encouragement sort of thing. This is a coffee stout. You know, coffee is something you drink when you go for something important and stay alert. I think what's coffee stouts are dime a dozen. I think what's cool about it is, you know, we partnered with a local roaster who is doing incredible things in Hong Kong called 18 Grams. And we worked with them to find a blend of beans that sort of paired with our coffee as well, sort of dark, fruity, chocolatey. And we actually roasted malt together with the beans to start sort of the flavor marriage right from that stage. So we used a lot of base malt together with raw coffee beans roasted together, or sort of we roasted coffee beans halfway. And malt went in, and, you know, they were roasted together.
And you did this at the coffee roaster?
Yeah, the coffee roaster.
So you roasted the malt in the coffee roaster.
That's right. Cool. Yeah. So and then we got this mixture of malt and beans, which went into the mash.
Wow.
And then, you know, went through the regular brewing process. And then afterwards, we again sort of did a cold infusion through our hop gun with the same coffee beans as well.
It's delicious.
It is really delicious.
Those are really good. I like to use the word marriage. Like it really does taste like a good combination of a stout and a cup of coffee.
And it's not at all acrid.
No,
you don't
no,
have
it's
the stringency and acridity of a lot of roasted malts and what you can potentially get by.
Yeah, we gave it some time as well to make sure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hong Kong is a big melting pot of cultures, and you have food from all over the world in there, and a lot of diversity of it. But there's a surprising lack of good pizza there.
Yes.
What should we do about that?
Yeah, so you know, through sort of my involvement in beer in the restaurant world, I got to know a few people, and I think we're going to do something about it. A few of us who actually have a New York connection, we've lived in Hong Kong, my friends Paul and a guy named Pat, who used to sort of manage Hong Kong's oldest running pub with a lot of craft beer called The Globe. So we got together and we decided to do another neighborhood project to bring the idea of good beer, good food, and essentially a friendly neighborhood bar. And then we together thought it'd be cool to do high quality pizza and pair it with a proper craft beer bar. And that's a combination you don't, you know, certainly great pizza is not, you know, not common in Hong Kong. And at the same time, I think the combination of like a proper sort of craft beer taproom and pizza is also non-existent. So we decided to, you know, work on that project, and that brought us to New York.
The pizza capital of the world! Yes.
Best pizza capital of the world.
How many,
unquestionable. How
many
pizzaed out yet?
Yeah, how many different pizzas places did you guys hit?
So we made this little booklet which had like, you know, a form to sort of fill, you know, we didn't want it to feel like, you know, just a vacation. So we wanted to make it feel like we're actually doing some work. So we had space for about about 30 or 40 pies to review. And I think we filled pretty much the entire book. And this was over a period of 3 days.
Yeah, the rest of the guys left today, right?
Yes.
And you guys got here on Tuesday or Wednesday?
Wednesday night.
We saw you Saturday night, you were... Yeah. I asked how many pizza places, and the list was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I mean, New York is endless. I think we could continue for probably a month.
Yeah.
And not go through, you know, the top tier.
That's like one borough.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, now you have to tell us what the best pizza is.
You know, that's
as we sit in a pizza restaurant. Right,
yeah. So I think what we wanted to accomplish in this trip wasn't. You know, let's find the best possible best pizza in New York, sort of this mythical best pizza. What we wanted to do is really deconstruct and assess what attributes we want in our individual style. Yeah. When it comes to crust, the degree of airiness, the weight, the size, you know, the amount of cheese and the acidity or the sweetness of the sauce and so on and so forth. So we wanted to, like, really figure out what we genuinely like as individual attributes.
How very scientific.
I think it's awesome.
It's great.
I mean, I've done,
My brother's going to be there all the time, for sure, in Hong Kong.
Well, wait, on the break, you were mentioning Brewtopia, right?
Yeah.
They had just done at least a few of them when we went there 3 years old.
Yeah.
So tell us about it.
So Beertopia has been one of the, you know, big sort of, you know, tailwinds that the Hong Kong craft beer scene has experienced. The first one started, I want to say about 4 or 5 years ago, you know, it was in a small venue. It was extremely packed, but it was essentially about, I want to say about 1,500 people. From that point, it has grown within 5 years to more than 20,000 attendees. You know, and lots of beer vendors, obviously. Over the last couple of years, what we've seen is that it's more and more local breweries as well. You know, the beer festival features imports as well as local breweries, and it keeps growing. It's now hosted in a beautiful venue, beautiful setting in Central Harbourfront. You're by the water and you look at the Hong Kong skyline, and it's in October when the weather is perfect in Hong Kong, and it's done a lot for the Hong Kong beer scene.
And so when you mean local, are you talking about Hong Kong breweries as well as China breweries?
There's a couple of China breweries who come as well, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
You don't have a New York accent.
Yeah.
But you move there from here.
I would say the majority of people don't have a New York accent.
I don't even know what a New York accent is. I'm just putting that out there. I'm only saying. Where's your family from?
My family is from India, in New Delhi. I've been moving around. I lived in Singapore and then New Hampshire and New York and back in Hong Kong.
When did your passion for homebrewing or craft beer begin?
Yeah. So, I mean, in some ways, it's been around for a long time when I lived in Singapore, but I would say I really started thinking more about it when I moved to New Hampshire for school, for grad school. And there I had a lot of incredible beer. I used to drink some, you know, non-macro beer in some of the brew pubs in Singapore, but I don't think it was anywhere near the level of variety and quality that I experienced after moving, to the U.S. So I still remember one of the first beers was like a brown ale from Smutty Nose. And I used to drink a lot of that, and then Harpoon and lots of the other sort of New England area breweries, and I got more and more into it.
I love it.
So I want to ask the brewery. So you have two different breweries.
Yeah.
Is the smaller brewery focusing on the first and smaller brewery focusing on certain beers? Like, how are you?
Yeah, so I think it's a very simple thing. Small brewery focuses on small batch beers. We make more of our core beers in the new brewery. But on the other hand, so I think whenever we sort of want to make something experimental and we have a new idea, we go make a batch in sort of our first brewery. But the second brewery also has now, I mean, we started a very small barrel aging program from day one, but now we have a much more expanded sort of barrel aging program with sort of, you know, a wide range bourbon, brandy, tequila, Chardonnay barrels, and bring a variety of beers in there. And we also bought a fooder to do some wild mixed fermentations. All of that is housed in the new brewery now. So it's a mix of the new brewery makes core beers as well as so the barrel aged and the mixed fermentation beers, whereas the old brewery makes just anything we like as a one off.
What are some of the more interesting one-offs that you've made recently?
There's a long list. I think last year we wanted to make a plain and simple Lichtenhainer, which I personally enjoyed a lot. It was a smoked sour beer. We went through a lot of thought process on, like, you know, should we add some smoked plums to it, which is a very Hong Kong ingredient. But ultimately, you know, we're like, wait a minute, we're already doing a smoked sour, so let's... let's start with that, and I think we're going to take it forward. We've been doing a lot of kettle-soured beers. We make a Goza, obviously, and we made something called a Galactic Sour. Galactic using, you know, we used Galaxy hops. It was like a hoppy sour IPA. All the hops were added, you know, at the end of the boil. And it was like, you know, deep sort of passion fruit kind of flavor to it, and the tartness from the kettle souring sort of made it taste like you're actually biting into a passion fruit. And I think next or 2 weeks from now, we are brewing that again, but this time we're actually going to add passion fruit to it to sort of, you know, take it to the next level. So yeah, we've made lots of barrel aged beers. I brought a barrel aged quad, which is personally, really interesting to me, because when my second son was born, we brewed it and we named it after him, and it's a, you know, classic Belgian quad aged in rye whiskey barrels for about a year.
And how are you getting your barrels?
To this day, all from the States. We buy it through various barrel brokers who buy barrels from distilleries, and we try to time to the best of our ability to sort of get the barrels as soon as they're emptied. We air freight them over, and
Wow! Because
they're expensive enough.
Yes,
locally.
Yeah. That's pretty epic. That's pretty cool.
That's commitment. Yeah.
So, are you finding that? Obviously, you're making, you know, you made a hopped kettle sour, a barrel aged quad. Are you finding that you guys are kind of leading some of the taste in consumers, or, you know, are you seeing that people have had, you know, some crazy American beers or Belgium or whatever, and you're, you know, how are you seeing people's taste change?
Yeah, I think to us it's more about just opening people's minds at this point. I think it's more, let's make new things that are nice balanced beers. We're not making things for the sake of being extreme, but we are trying to marry elements of Hong Kong culture and elements of traditional brewing cultures in a thoughtful manner. So it's all rooted and it has a story behind it. So we essentially want to make sure we keep doing that because, you know, as we all know, beer is extremely diverse and can be many things. And I think the local Hong Kong audience, particularly the younger generation, does not necessarily... I mean, sometimes what we're finding is that our followers may not even... We are fortunate that way, that they don't have a lot of preconceived notions. Sometimes the beers we make or other local breweries make may even be their first beer. So making all of these different beers is allowing us to sort of dispel the notion. Some people are like, you know, I don't like beer, but, you know, wait till you try this sour, for example, and we found wine drinkers enjoying, you know, some of our low-hopped sour beers and so on and so forth.
Cool.
Before we go, I would be remiss not to. I would like to try the Weizenbach.
Yeah,
Weizenbach.
Absolutely.
And you, your first brewer there, was a German.
Yes.
And he came from brewing in mainland China until coming to you, right? Oh, here you go. This. Oh, look, we have it open before I can come out of the thing. Yeah. He always wanted to make this beer. And Uli was a really great guy and brought over some traditional German brewing, including Spundit brewing, right? Which is, can you describe that process?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Uli, essentially our founding brewmaster, we used to call him Uli, Ulrich Altbauer. I personally learned a lot from him. You know, sadly, right after our second brewery went into commission, tragically, he passed away. Uli, I think, you know, I think in my experience, he's the safest pair of hands in front of a brew house that I've seen in my life. He was a very conservative but very very safe brewer who would, you know, deliver consistency and quality. You know, on the other hand, some of us younger guys in the team would be like, let's do this and that crazy stuff. He would he would listen to us. Initially, he would dismiss it, but then eventually find a way to make it happen. But he would always say, you know, he would always talk about, you know, beers that have nothing funny in them. And he would talk about sort of beers that have a kick. He enjoyed, you know, stronger beers. Mm-hmm. So I think Weizenbach was something that was always on our mind, and he wanted to brew one. Unfortunately, we didn't get to make it in his lifetime, but you know, we thought it'd be a fitting tribute to make one, which was you know, a little bit darker than a classic Weizenbach, a little bit of roast, but otherwise a very classic Weizenbach with sort of the, you know, the banana clove esters and sort of the rich malty backbone. So we brewed it to also raise some proceeds for his surviving family.
Fantastic. Well, Rohit, thank you so much for bringing this and sharing it. And thank you for joining us on Ferment About It.
Thank you for having me.
How can we find out more information about Young Master Ales and about the three projects that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, follow us on social media at Young Master Ales, one word, on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Youngmasterales.com is a website. If you're ever in Hong Kong, look up the Ale Project, Second Draft, or, you know, an upcoming pizza place called Alvey's.
Alvey's. We didn't know that name.
All the beer, you know, craft beer lovers out there, now is a great time to travel to Hong Kong.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's always a great time.
Yeah.
All right. Ferment About It. Yeah. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.